Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Of all the things to do this year, the one that stood out on my calendar that I've been thinking about over and over and over again is this talk tonight. Mostly because of the deep and powerful importance of Dr. Keeling, and indeed of Scripps, in the history of this most important question that we've ever faced. I think one can go beyond saying that he was the first scientist to have a career in global warming. One of the very few people on the planet who can lay real claim to the idea that they alerted an entire globe to its fate. The only other two people I can think of who might belong in that realm are two scientists I've gotten to know over the years, Mario Molina and Sherry Rowland, who told us first about the destruction of the ozone layer and won the Nobel for that work. And I remember Sherry describing going home to his wife and her asking how things were going. And he said, well, the science is going very well, and it looks like the planet is going very badly, he said. And something of that, I'm sure, hung over Dr. Keeling his entire life. Not an easy thing to be the person who bears the most important news, who put up what inarguably is the most important scientific instrument in the world, who's responsible for allowing humanity to figure out whether or not it's going to take the steps that it could and must take to deal with this most pressing of problems. 23 years ago, when I wrote The End of Nature, which was the first book for a general audience about this kind of thing, we, of course, basically understood all that we needed to know. We knew that we were putting lots of carbon in the atmosphere, thanks to Dr. Keeling, and we knew that its molecular structure trapped heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. The only thing really we didn't know was how fast and how hard this would pinch. And I think the burden of the last 20 years is that it's pinching much harder and much faster than we would have expected. And I think that the reason that that's true is twofold. One is that scientists, you know, by their nature, are a conservative lot, prone to underestimate rather than overestimate. But I think also it's because it was very hard for any of us psychologically to imagine that we would really be able to tip the planet off kilter. But suffice it to say that we've reached the point, as great scientists like Jim Hansen predicted 20 years ago we would, where it's quite clear now to ordinary people in the street that change is upon us. Even in the last few years, the polling has indicated a sharp spike in the number of Americans, the most recalcitrant and in denial of all citizens of this planet, a sharp spike even here in the number of people worried about global warming. And the reason all the research indicates for that spike is because people are now seeing around them the effects of this change in the incidence of drought and of flood, in the melt of most things frozen on the planet, and for those who are paying just slightly closer attention, in changes that really we didn't even quite think were possible two or three decades ago. The most powerful being the rapid acidification of the planet's oceans. The oceans are our metaphor for vastness. It's remarkable that we've been able to fundamentally alter their chemistry, and yet we have. So, the important thing, I think, about the science is merely to say that, as you all know, We stand only at the beginning of this era, and the same climatologists who warned us that what would happen has what has happened would happen, now warn us that without dramatic change, without getting off coal and gas and oil far faster than any government is currently planning, the change we've seen so far, a rise in temperature of slightly less than a degree centigrade, will be triple or quadruple that before the century is out, and the results will be too difficult even for us really to contemplate. I think there's no point sitting here and going through the litany of terrors that one can confidently expect in that kind of world, in a world where the production of ample food will become a haphazard at best operation, in a world where people already short of water in many places will find it impossible to stay where they are and be set in motion with all the conflict and sadness that that inevitably involves, where vast numbers of our fellow creatures will find it unable to maintain their foothold on this planet. On and on and on, that litany needs no explanation. What needs explication are the range of possibilities still before us to do anything about it. And it must be said here too, that the range is much narrower than it was when Dr. Keeling began his work, or even when I wrote The End of Nature. Things that were possible to imagine then, a kind of gradual and relatively easy transition away from fossil fuel and onto something else, no longer are possible to imagine in the same way because we've wasted the intervening decades. And now we have to move, if we're going to move, more quickly, more dramatically than is easy or comfortable for any of our political or economic systems to encompass. That's the political corollary of the chemistry and physics of the situation, and it's as implacable as that chemistry and that physics. Which means that we're therefore, I think, called to think very realistically about how to make those changes in the time that we have. Now, I could spend 40 minutes talking about the sets of technologies that make these changes possible now. The things like sun and wind that we did not know how to fully exploit 20 years ago, but that now we have a much better sense of how to exploit. I spent part of the afternoon over at the, I'm going to clutch on its name now, the California Center for Sustainable Energy. One of the places on this planet where people have worked out not only the technical details, but the kind of human details, the things like how to finance and spread around these technologies. I'm not going to spend 40 minutes talking about those things because I think they're the easy part. The part we can almost take for granted, the part that human beings are good at. We're good at innovating and problem solving and building things. What we're not good at least so far, is making the set of political arrangements that would allow us to do this work in the time that we have. The scientific method has proved itself over the last 40 years. And people should be very proud of it. We took the most difficult possible problem in atmospheric physics and chemistry and put that powerful dialectic to work and reached in short order, relatively short order, a robust consensus about what was happening, an approximation of the scale and pace of what was going on, and a pretty clear set of indications about what fundamentally needed to be done, most of all, stop pouring carbon into the atmosphere. As well as the scientific method has worked, that is about how badly the political method has failed to deal with this problem. And over that same period, in Washington and around the planet, we've basically had a multi-decade effort to do nothing. And it's been bipartisan, and it's been highly successful. We have done essentially nothing, given the scale of the problem. And so the question becomes, first, why is that? And second, how do we change that? As to the question of why, there are a number of answers. This is one of the things that the social scientists would say are overdetermined, which there are many causes for. There's a lot of inertia in our systems. The biologists tell us that human psychology favors reaction to short-term threats and stimulus, not longer-term, on and on and on. But those things, after 25 years of working on this, strike me as secondary and tertiary. The primary cause that we have made so little change is the power of the fossil fuel industry to block that change. They are the most powerful, profitable enterprise in human history. That's not hyperbole. Exxon has made more money each of the last 5 years than any company in the history of money. Okay? And they make that much money because they have a special privilege not granted to any other business. They are allowed to pour their waste into the atmosphere for free. Nobody else gets to do that. If you run a restaurant in San Diego, the cheapest way for you to deal with your trash at the end of the day would be to shovel it out in the middle of the street and leave it there. But if you did that, your profits would go up. Within short order, the city would be overrun with rats. So we figured out a couple of hundred years ago that that was not what we were going to allow. You have to take care of your waste unless you're the fossil fuel industry, in which case you get to pour the most dangerous waste we know about into the atmosphere for free. That's why they're the most profitable. It's why the rate of adoption of solar and wind and things is far too slow to change the basic trajectory of temperature. And it's why they will fight very hard in order to preserve that special privilege. And that fight, that's the real fight that's going on. They've been able to use some of that money to warp our democracies in powerful ways. And so if we're going to overcome it, then the analysis I'm giving you anyway suggests that we're going to have to find some other currency in which to work. We're never going to have that much money, so we need to figure out things that they do not have if we're going to make this happen. One of them, and it's a very basic and bottom line one, is the science, the reason, the intelligence necessary to figure out the problem. And that, at this point, we've been granted. Science has done its work, done most of it, and done it splendidly. Beyond that, we need the currencies of movements. We need passion and spirit and creativity. We need to be able to put those things to work in large numbers in order, hopefully, to checkmate the power of that industry and do something about it. Now, I've been talking very grandly here, as if I understand all this to a fault. And I do not. We're moving into a realm, unlike the discussion of the science, that one can footnote and provide citation for. Movement building is more an art than a science, and it's a pretty dark art at that, because it hasn't been done effectively all that often, okay? And certainly not on a global scale. And it was not what I set out to do in this world at all. I am a writer by trade, which means, in essence, that what I would most like to do in the world is sit in my room and type, okay? That's what gives me pleasure. And it's why I'm not particularly good at giving speeches and things. If I was adept at other forms of communication, I probably would not have been a writer, okay? But at some point in the last few years, last decade, it became clear to me that writing was not enough. And the moment might have been when I was in Bangladesh on a trip, and Bangladesh, as you know, is a beautiful, beautiful country, one of the greenest, most fertile places on earth. 140 million people squeezed into an area the size of Wisconsin, but they feed themselves. It's so fertile. The great sacred rivers of Asia, the Ganges and the Brahmaputra, come pouring down out of the Himalayas into the Bay of Bengal. Over the long run, they're in big trouble from climate change. The Bay of Bengal rising fast, already flooding fields. Eventually, those glaciers up there will fail. When I was there, though, the trouble they were having was acute, not chronic. They were having their first big outbreak of dengue fever, this mosquito-borne disease that spread like wildfire around the world in the last 20 years, especially Asia and South America, because Aedes aegypti, the mosquito that spreads it, dearly loves the warm, wet world that we're building on its behalf. I mean, if you were looking at this planet through a telescope from some distant galaxy, trying to figure out what we were doing, why we were suddenly altering our atmosphere dramatically, a reasonable hypothesis would be that we had embarked on a planetary-scale mosquito ranching operation, and this was our, you know, easiest method to accomplish it. Okay, so they were having their first big outbreak of this stuff, and it was terrifying to people because they hadn't had it before, and there were big blown-up pictures of this mosquito on the front page of the papers and things. I was spending a lot of time in the slums, so I eventually got bit by the wrong mosquito, and I was as sick as I've ever been. But, of course, I didn't die because I was strong and healthy and well-fed going into it. That wasn't true for a lot of people. A lot of people did die, and I remember being in the clinic, and there's, you know, much bigger than this, people lying on cots just shivering and shaking. And I remember thinking, not only was I thinking, boy, do I feel bad, I was thinking, boy, is this not fair. 140 million people there, but when the UN tries to measure how much carbon each country emits, Bangladesh, it's a rounding error. You can't even really get a number for it. I mean, people don't drive cars, by and large. Most aren't hooked up to the electric grid. Not their fault. The 4% of us in this country are responsible at the moment for somewhere north of a quarter of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, because we've been putting them up there for a long time, okay? And when I sort of saw that, when I saw it viscerally, it just felt to me like it was time to do more than write about this, that we were going to have to do more than write about it, but I didn't know what. In fact, I had no idea at all. I'm a writer, and I live up in the mountains in Vermont, our second smallest state. And so when I got home, I called up my other writer friends, a couple of them in Vermont, and said, here's what we'll do. We'll go up to the federal building in Burlington. That's our main city. It only has 50,000 people, so it's not that main, but it's what we got, you know. And so we'll go up to the federal building, and we'll sit in on the steps, and we'll get arrested, and there'll be a little story in the paper, and at least we will have done something. And these other writers were as clueless as I was about it. They said, oh, that sounds like a good idea, you know, let's do it. Until one of them happily called up to the police in Burlington, said, what will happen if we try this intrepid stunt? And the police said, nothing will happen. Stay there as long as you want. So we had to recalibrate, you know. And I sent out an email to everybody saying we're going to go for a walk. And we left a couple of weeks later from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up in the Green Mountains, because he's kind of our patron saint, you know. And we walked for 5 days, and we slept in farm fields along the way. And I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, hence that book about Christmas. So I'd called up all the kind of Methodist mafia en route to make sure that there'd be potluck suppers and things along the way. And eventually we got to Burlington, and there were 1,000 people marching. Okay, so you guys live in a great metropolis, you know. To you, 1,000 people is nothing. But in Vermont, this, you know, with the possible exception of University of Vermont hockey games, this is as many people as gather for any purpose. And it was enough to bring all our politicians down to meet with us on the shore of Lake Champlain, and not just meet with us. They all signed this statement we've been carrying hither and yon, promising that they would work hard to cut carbon emissions dramatically. And it wasn't just the Liberal Democrats, of which we have some who signed. It was the woman who was running for the Republican our one congressional seat, Republican nominee who almost won, she had said 2 months before, when she announced, she said, this was 2006, she said, I'm not sure global warming is real, more research needs to be done, which actually I fear would now pass as a progressive position within the Republican Party. But she said, you know, it turned out that the more research that needed to be done was on the topic, how many people will walk across Vermont and ask me to change my mind, you know? And empirically, 1,000 was sufficient because she signed. And that was good. That's how it's supposed to work. The only hard part was to open the paper the next morning and read this story in the Burlington paper that said that this 1,000 people that had gathered in 2006 on the shore of Lake Champlain was the largest demonstration that had yet taken place in the United States about climate change. So when I read that, I thought, no wonder that we lose. We have the superstructure here of a movement, you know. We've got Al Gore, we've got scientists, we've got engineers, we've got policy people and economists. We have all the answers. The only part of the movement that we forgot was the movement part. There's nothing there to give it any heft, you know, anything to work with. And so we decided to start seeing if we could do something beyond the confines of Vermont to raise attention, to raise pressure. And that's when I asked Jim Hansen, actually. Said, you know what? We need a number here. What is the number? And he said, you know, it's funny. I've been wondering that, too. And he set his team to work. And in January of 08, they produced a paper saying, we really know enough about carbon to give a first-order approximation of that number. Said any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization evolved and to which life on Earth is adapted. Which those of you, and there are many of you who are used to reading scientific papers, know that that's stronger language than people usually adopt in peer-reviewed operations. It was stern language, and sterner still since, as you all know, the atmosphere outside here and everywhere is 393 parts per million and rising in that inexorable Keeling curve, 2 parts or better a year now. So it was a really depressing paper to read. I mean, it was a kind of final statement that we weren't going to stop global warming. At worst, at best, we were going to keep it from getting worse than it had to. But it did give us the clue that we needed about how to try and organize. We were thinking about how do you organize around the world, and the biggest problem you face organizing around the world is that everybody insists on speaking their own language. Okay? So how do you, there's no slogan you can pick. But Arabic numerals have the pleasant property of skipping across those linguistic boundaries undamaged, you know. And so we thought, huh, you wouldn't normally pick a wonky scientific data point around which to organize. And in fact, everybody told us we were nuts. They said, no one will understand this. It's too complicated, whatever. But we decided to try. We were formed 350.org. Now, when I say we formed it, it sounds like it must be a formidable operation that we had formed. It's myself and 7 undergraduates at Middlebury College in Vermont. Okay, and we had no money or anything else. This was 2008. But 7 was the, you know, 7 kids. There are 7 continents. Each one of them took one. The guy who got the Antarctic also got the internet, okay? And we set out to organize. And to organize, by our definition, was to find people like ourselves who were thinking the same kind of things. Now, not everywhere in the world is there a category called environmentalist, but there's always somebody who's worried about hunger or about development or about war and peace or about all the things you cannot have on a planet that's quickly disintegrating in that way. And so those were the people we sought out. And at the beginning, we said, we're going to try and have a day. We're going to take one day and try to inject this number and this idea into the information bloodstream of the planet, you know. And the day we picked was almost at random, October 24th, 2009. We'd done training camps for young people. I went in Turkey for Central Asia and one in the Caribbean and One in Johannesburg, where we brought a couple of kids from each country in Africa down. Most had never been on an airplane before or anything, but they all came down, and they're all good organizers. And they all fanned out back around the world. And we didn't hear from them all the time, because there's large parts of the planet still, you know, parts of Africa and things, where you can't just Skype people easily. But we knew they were working. And we got the first sense that this might actually work 2 days early on the Thursday before this Saturday. We were the eight of us sitting around a little office, borrowed office in Manhattan, around a table, our laptops open, doing press releases, and the phone rings. And on the other end, it's a kind of bad satellite connection from Addis Ababa. And on the other end is our leader in Ethiopia, volunteers like all of us, Lily, who's 17 years old. And she's almost in tears, and she said, you know, the government took away our permit for Saturday. Ethiopia, not a very nice government. They took away our permit for Saturday. So we're doing it today before they can stop us, which was a pretty brave thing to do. But she was, the reason she was in tears, she said, we don't want to spoil it for everybody else. We don't want to jump the gun for everybody. We were so looking forward to doing it at the same exact moment as everybody else. And we've got 15,000 kids right now out in the street in Addis Ababa chanting 350. You know? So I was like, Lily, it's okay about the date, you know, don't worry. And after that, you know, for the next like 72 hours, it was kind of miraculous. The pictures just kept rolling in from the most unlikely. I mean, the next picture that came was U.S. troops in Afghanistan. We had a 350 with sandbags, sent us a note saying we're parking our Humvee for the weekend and walking. Okay. Before the weekend was over, there had been 5,100 demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN called it the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. Okay. And the thing, I just want to show you a couple of pictures. The thing I want you really to see, because it's what struck me the most as I was looking through it, was that this thing that I had heard all my life, that environmentalism was something for rich white people who had taken care of their other problems, and that if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from, you wouldn't be an environmentalist, that just turns out to be complete and utter nonsense. Most of the people we work with around the world are poor and black and brown and Asian and young, because that's what most of the people in the world are. And oddly enough, they care just as much about the future as anybody else, maybe more so, because the future bears down hard on you if you're in these places. So there were pictures, that's dugout canoes someplace on the Congo River above Kinshasa, you know, near what Conrad in his Eurocentric way called the heart of darkness, you know. And they didn't have a digital camera. They developed it in somebody's home dark room, and it didn't come out so well, so they wrote in what their banner had said. But I thought it was a good sign, you know. And just pictures, I mean, most of them big demonstrations, but some places just beautiful, creative, funny things, you know. Huge involvement of religious communities for the first time in this work. So there's South Africa. There's the head of Muslim South Africa, of indigenous traditions in South Africa behind them in the scarlet. Desmond Tutu's successor is Anglican Archbishop at the head of a huge multi-faith march. There's our biggest evangelical college in this country. I've been to Bethlehem to do some organizing. Hard place even to get to, but the Dead Sea is shrinking as temperatures rise and people wanted to do something. Too many military barriers in the way, so the Jordanian said, we'll make the three on our beach. The Palestinian said, we'll do the five in Palestine. The Israeli said, we'll take care of the zero. All over the place. 300 demonstrations across China. One of them got broken up by the police, but the others went off just right. If there's one country in the world that's been our greatest ally in this work, it's the Maldives, entirely Muslim nation. Maybe the prettiest place on earth. 1,200 islands strung across the equator in the Indian Ocean. White sand beaches, palm trees, paradise, except that the highest point in the whole archipelago is about a meter and a half above sea level. That 5,000-year-old culture is, you know, not, I would say, good odds to reach 5,100 years old. They set aside money in the budget each year to try and buy a homeland someplace else. Though who knows where, since South Asia is not exactly full of vacant real estate, you know, to go purchase. But they are working so hard. They're determined to become the first carbon neutral nation on Earth by 2020, but they're also working hard politically. There's the Student Government Association holding their meeting in the lagoon to demonstrate their plight. For 36 hours, this was the lead story at Google News, the most covered story in the world, you know. And I think the biggest reason was that to editors and stuff, the pictures seemed so unlikely because they did not look like our image of environmentalists. If you look at that, it's in Yemen, which is the toughest country on earth maybe at the moment, you know. If you look at the zero, it's all women in full black burqa. So to us, they do not look like the Sierra Club, you know. But their hearts are in exactly the same place. They're not worrying about themselves. They're worrying about the future, about what their children's lives will be like and how it will be. Their hearts are in the same place that your guys' hearts are. In fact, we have the wonderful people from 350 San Diego here tonight. And they've got, you guys have clipboards, right? You're going to pass them around. I hope you'll give them your names. They're doing amazing work here with 350, and they'll sign you up too, just to, so you'll get sort of the occasional email on, about what we're doing. But these are the people who are your brothers and sisters in all this work, and they're everywhere, and sometimes in very unlikely places. That's the oil-rich sheikdom of Abu Dhabi, and those are some oil-rich sheikhs, you know, down front. But they're wiser than your average oil-rich, you know, people. If you look behind them, you see the edge of the largest solar array on the planet. I think their plan is to remain rich no matter what, you know, we're burning. There were about 500 pictures that ended up in a file just called 350 Adorable, okay? And they really were adorable, and they also really were sad. I mean, there's a pretty good chance that those beautiful girls will be refugees by the time they're old enough to be mothers, you know? And they won't be able to do a damn thing to stop it. We might be able to, all right? That's my team delivering all those photos to the UN a few days later. I wish I could tell you that this had been completely successful. It was sort of successful. We got to Copenhagen in that big climate conference 6 weeks later, and we convinced 117 nations to sign on to this 350 target, which we thought was pretty good. But of course, they were the wrong 117 nations. They were all the poor ones. Okay, and the addicts, led by us, weren't yet willing to come to terms with our addiction. And so that meeting, which, you know, in the movie should have been like the place where the whole world comes together and rallies, you know, just ended in a fizzle. And I thought maybe that would fizzle this whole movement, you know, that it would be just too discouraging. But instead, people around the world were made of sterner stuff than me, and they've rallied. They rallied even though 6 months later the U.S. Senate couldn't even bring itself to take a vote on the most tame, tepid, mild climate legislation imaginable. They were so scared of the fossil fuel industry that they would not even vote on it, you know? And so we're going to have to. I mean, the lesson, clearly, is build a movement bigger and stronger, and we've kept doing it. We've had four altogether of these huge global days of action. This was a thing we did called the Global Work Party all over the world, where we were getting people putting up solar panels and digging community gardens. And, you know, by this point, this was a year later, we were operational in every country on Earth except North Korea, where we're still not operational, I might add. But that was, you know, part of the campaign we did around the White House to get them to put solar panels back up on the roof. You remember I was telling you that this is a question as much of politics as technology? When I was in China last year doing a piece for the National Geographic, I got to go to spend a day with the guy who runs the biggest solar thermal company on Earth, Solar Hot Water, which in China, 250 million Chinese, when they take a shower at night, the hot water's coming off the roof. They have about 25% penetration of this technology compared to less than 1% in this country, and even that 1% is mostly used for heating swimming pools. Okay. When I talked with the guy who heads the company, he was an engineer, we had a nice long afternoon of fun talk about this stuff, and then he was telling me about his private museum, and he said, you know what the pride of place in that museum is? It's a solar panel. Do you know what solar panel? I said, I have no clue. He said, yeah, it's one of the solar panels that Jimmy Carter put on the White House in 1979 and Ronald Reagan took down in 1985. We've done our best to get them to put them back up on the White House, and in fact, the Obama administration promised finally after a long campaign that they would put them up, and they promised, in fact, that they'd be up by spring 2011. But in fact, they're not yet up. and there's no particular explanation as to why not, so we'll keep trying. But this kind of stuff all over the world, in just, you know, unlikely places, places where they have other things to worry about, where much is going on. There's our friends in Auckland, New Zealand, who trained about 100 bike mechanics on that Global Work Party Day, and they spread out all over the city, and they fixed every bicycle they could find. They just went into people's garages and took them down off hooks and put new tires on them and whatever else, so that no one would have an excuse for not riding their bike, you know, and gardeners, and, you know, just every place you can imagine, including the toughest places on earth, you know. It takes something to be sitting in Somalia in the midst of war and famine and everything else to sit and plant a tree, you know. That's about all you can do there, and they were doing it. And then last fall, with the big help from people here in San Diego, we did this day of, we called it Moving Planet, that was all focused on transportation and mostly on bicycles and things all over the world. Because, you know, this is another part of this problem that we can lick. It's perfectly possible to do it. If you go to Copenhagen now, 40% of people are bicycling, commuting to work. 40% in a place where actually it gets somewhat colder and darker in the winter than it does in San Diego, you know. And just every place around the world, you know, the same kind of action. We've even done our best to bring the artistic impulse to bear. We did this. That's, some of you may know Tom York of Radiohead, the lead singer of Radiohead. He's one of our collaborators. So he got 3,000 of his fans to come to Brighton Beach, and he gave them all blue raincoats, and they made that great image of King Canute trying to hold back the water, you know, there along the beach. That was on a day when we had huge art installations like that all around the world. That's, again, people making that image of someone fleeing a house against the rising seas. These were so big that we had to borrow a satellite to take images of them from outer space. There was no other way to see most of them, and they were extremely beautiful. That was my favorite of all. It's a dry riverbed in Santa Fe, and at the exact moment that the satellite passed over, 1,000 people put blue sheets up above their heads, and it was as if the river had just sprung magically to life. This kind of work is beautiful and powerful, and one of the things it should say, and I think to scientists this should be heartening, is that people are completely capable of dealing with this science. You'll notice that that number was everywhere, including in lots of places where people are illiterate and uneducated, and they have no problem with it. It turns out that when you tell someone that this is how much you can have of something and you have this much of it, they get the concept, you know? It's sort of like going to the doctor and the doctor saying, your cholesterol is too high now, and you're going to have a heart attack. You might already have had a small stroke, you know? That's when you get people's attention. And only, you know, very few people turn to the doctor and say, I want an entire disquisition now on the lipid system before I go any farther. And only the stupidest go home and search the internet for some website that tells them cholesterol does not exist, you know. That's the kind of message that's getting across, thank heaven, all over the world. But it's not enough, this kind of educational effort. We also have to be willing to take strong steps to make sure that that movement that we're building really pays off. And I'm going to give you one example from the last year, and it's this work we've done to try and stop this pipeline down out of the tar sands of Canada. And the reason we started it a year ago, right now, I'd never heard of the Keystone Pipeline. But Jim Hansen, again, said you guys might want to take a look at what's going on up there, because that's the second biggest pool of carbon on the planet. If you could, you can't happily, but if you could torch off tonight all the oil underground in Alberta, you'd raise the CO2 level in the atmosphere to 540 parts per million tonight. There's a lot of carbon up there, okay? There's a lot of carbon a lot of other places too, but this is one big pool of it. And So we started looking at it and learned that there was this plan to build the first really big straw into that, you know, dirty milkshake up there, this Keystone Pipeline down to the Gulf of Mexico so you could export this stuff all over the world. And we didn't know if we could beat it, but we determined that we best take a shot at it. And so we sent out a letter signed by a couple of scientists, and I wrote it. Wendell Berry, the great Kentucky author and essayist, one of my great heroes, signed it, and Naomi Klein and a few other people. And we asked people, will you come to Washington? And will you come to Washington and get arrested? And we didn't know how things would happen. We said we're going to do it for 2 weeks. And that first day, 80 people showed up to get arrested, which was more than we'd expected and way, way more than the police had expected. They're used to dealing with two or three people at a time in this kind of thing, and they have it all worked out. They take them away to the station and fine them $100 and release them and things. But they looked at us, said, there's too many of you, and we do not want to do this for 2 weeks. We're going to try to deter people. They said it straight out loud. So the first wave of us got to spend 3 days in Central Cell Block in D.C., which is exactly as much fun as it sounds like it would be. But no matter, because it did not deter anybody. The second day, while we were in jail, 100 people showed up to get arrested. And the next day, 120. By the time we were done that 2 weeks, 1,253 people had been arrested. It was the biggest civil disobedience action about anything in 30 years in this country. Okay, and it spread. It spread pretty fast, and the Canadians started doing it. They had the biggest civil disobedience action ever on Parliament Hill, you know. And then our friends around the world started shutting down for the day consulates and embassies all over the place, you know. And then we started following the president all over the country, and we were so polite. Wherever he went, he'd find groups of 300 or 400 people, and they just would be chanting, "Yes, we can stop the pipeline." And then we came back to Washington in November, and we circled the White House. We didn't know if we could, I mean, no one had tried it before, and we were on Google Earth trying to count how many people you'd have to circle. As it turned out, we didn't need to worry because we had enough people that we were shoulder to shoulder, five deep around this mile-long perimeter most of the way, you know, and it was beautiful. And there are people in this room who were here that day, and I'm really grateful to them. It was a beautiful day and very polite. Every sign we had was just a quote from President Obama in 2008. Time to end the tyranny of oil. In my administration, the rise of the oceans will begin to slow and the planet begin to heal, you know. We figured that would be harder for him to deal with than attack, you know. And indeed, 4 days later, the president said, okay, we're going to review this thing more carefully. We're going to take a year and more and deal with it. And it's a very temporary victory. Temporary victories are the only kind environmentalists ever win. And this one will be more temporary perhaps than most, because big oil did not like even that little loss. And they have fought back with hundreds of millions of dollars. And in the Congress, they're doing everything they can to stop it. And at the moment, pretty much the main person who's keeping them from approving this pipeline is your Senator Barbara Boxer. And we hope that you'll let her know. We hope you'll let her know that you're grateful and that you're depending on her to keep it up, because the pressure on all these guys is pretty intense. We're not going to stop global warming one pipeline at a time, one coal mine at a time, one fracking well at a time. There's too many of them. We'll keep fighting them. And the fight is a good one, and some of these are winnable, you know. The tar sands are, for the moment, kind of bottled up because our friends in Canada are doing an amazing job of blocking the possible pipeline to the Pacific that they're trying to build. Led mostly by First Nations people, indigenous people there, they're doing an amazing job of blocking it. But that's, you know, it's too many holes in the dike. We're like the little Dutch boy who would need 485 fingers to somehow stop them all. We can't do it that way. We're going to have to figure out how to go more directly at the fossil fuel industry. And part of that work is to convince people that this is a pressing need right now, that we cannot wait any longer, that we've got to get to work. I'm just going to tell you as I close about the work we've done in the last week. We did another one of these days, and I really wanted to show these because people in San Diego at 350 San Diego did such a great job with this human wave down on the beach. 10 days ago, the Friday with this day of action was we called Connect the Dots, was supposed to start. We woke up to see this billboard in Chicago, sponsored by the main fossil fuel denier front group called the Heartland Institute. And it's Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. And I still believe in global warming, do you? And I mean, this is not a strong, logical argument, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, it's like, I don't know what it's like, you know, Hitler wore pants, you know, or I mean, I don't know what it means, you know. But clearly the intent is to say people who care about climate change are zealots and fanatics and lunatics, okay? And so we were really happy that we, by that afternoon, were going to be able to show people what the real face of global warming looked like. To show people who had no choice but to believe in it because it was happening around them. So the first picture that came in on this worldwide day of action, because the sun rises across the international dateline first in that part of the Pacific, was the Marshall Islands. And there's our friends, you know, underwater demonstration. Your carbon emissions kill our coral, you know. And then the pictures, again, thousands of them, far more than I could ever hope to show you, but just coming from the most unlikely places. They've got one or two other things to worry about in Afghanistan right now, you know. But there they are in the main river, and there's not much of it left that waters Kabul. That's their water supply, you know, and reminding us of that. And the same thing in Kenya, and there they are in Auckland. And I don't have the San Diego picture because you can go home, and if you look at the video that we put together, if you go to the 350 website, it's the first thing on there. From all around the world. You'll see your neighbors hard at work. But in Aspen, where they had no snow this year, they were having a downhill ski race on the grass. And in Bellingham, Washington, up in the northwest corner of the country, where they're trying to build a huge coal port to export Powder River Basin coal over to China to get burned, where we're going to block it. We're going to try anyway. They're trying to put six of them up and down the Pacific coast. They were gathered there. And in Jordan, where the flow in the Jordan River is expected to fall as much as 80% over the course of this century, they were making giant drops of water. And in Russia, with forest fires. And there were happy pictures, you know. Johannesburg, the school children planting a garden. That's the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, kind of famous for being in this country for its connection with strife. But what are the kids interested in there? They're interested in bike paths. So there they are making a Micronesia, you know, not going to be there much longer. There's the Dead Sea, the top balloon, 26 meters. That's how much the water level has fallen in the Dead Sea since the 1960s. Not all because of climate change, but much. Some of the pictures were very hard to look at. I have no idea how in the most obscure parts of, you know, rural India, people even knew that it was going on. But there they were, and they somehow got the picture to us, and the one sentence note that came with the picture said, there is no longer any water behind our dam, period. Republic of Congo, Pakistan, which had those just unbelievable floods 2 years ago. In Karachi, they got in lifeboats to kind of demonstrate, and out in the countryside where they don't, you know, it's a sort of different culture, they just stood there bearing testament to what happened. 20 million people had to leave their homes in the course of those floods. I mean, just almost, that's almost the population of two-thirds the population of California, you know, out of their homes in one event. That guy's sign says, I don't know if my neighbors realize that climate change from global warming will exacerbate the violence of local storms because they are not home for me to ask them. We did one huge sign up on the Dana Glacier in the Sierras, one of the many melting glaciers, okay? And the question was, what should the sign say? And everybody was a big banner, size of a football field. Oh, it should have some earnest statement about climate change or whatever. I said, no, I think in this case, we're just going to quote from that prominent authority, the Wicked Witch of the West, you know, and the banner's just going to say, I'm melting. Here's near me in Vermont. I'm in there someplace. Vermont was in the path last fall of Hurricane Irene, the biggest natural disaster we've ever had. Our governor got up the next morning and said, for all intents and purposes, you know, it's now like Vermont's become a tropical country. It's like I'm the governor of Costa Rica, and it should not be this way. There was so much more water than we've ever had to cope with. That's that same picture from farther back, and you can see in our beautiful valley, the farm fields, you know, gone, covered with sand and gravel and whatever else. And the same story in Mongolia, and the same story in Afghanistan, and the same story in Kenya, and the same brave people in the Maldives. They'd had a military coup 3 weeks ago. No one was supposed to be out on the streets. There were demonstrations all over the Maldives that says, yes to 350, yes to democracy. Those are friends of ours in British Columbia getting arrested, stopping a coal train coming towards the coast. Those are people in Haiti. If you read the sign, it just says, your actions affect me. There's nothing that those guys can do to stop climate change. Not a thing, except try to appeal to the rest of us to do what we can. And the same all over the world. That's a pretty powerful picture that somebody staged in Brazil, a kind of exemplar to what we can expect. Look, let me just end by saying that there's no guarantee at all that we're going to win this fight. This experiment, first described by Dr. Keeling, and those were the words in which he used to describe it, you know, that a great experiment was now underway. That experiment, its outcome is uncertain and, frankly, somewhat dubious. And really what it's turned into, I think, is an experiment about the human spirit, about whether the big brain was a good adaptation, about whether it's attached to a kind of big enough heart to undo the sort of damage that we've done. And we do not know the answer to that, and it'll be determined by what we decide to do. Let me tell you two things about those arrests in Washington, because I think they're important, especially looking out at the demography of this crowd. Okay, young people have been at the heart of the movement about climate change around the world. They've carried most of the water in this fight all over the place, and you saw so many of their faces. When we were getting ready to do this civil disobedience, I was worried that they were going to be the cannon fodder again for this sort of thing. And it didn't seem right to me, because right now, if you're 22, an arrest record is not exactly what you need on your resume, you know, in our economy. So we asked people not to make that happen, and indeed, it was wonderful to see. One of the few privileges of growing older is, you know, past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you, you know? We didn't ask people how old they were when they came, but we did ask them, who was president when you were born? Okay? And the two biggest cohorts were from the FDR and the Truman administrations. And on the last day, there was a guy arrested with a sign around his neck that said, World War II vet, handle with care, you know? It was beautiful to see, and it was really important for young people to see their elders stepping up. And not just their elders, some of them, more than I'd expected, were scientists who have been reluctant, for the most part, to engage in the politics of this, to follow, you know, the work that they've done in the lab out into the rest of the world and make it work. And yet there were some, and this again made me, I was very impressed and slightly worried. There were a couple of great younger scientists in their 30s and 40s who didn't have tenure yet, you know. And I knew that this was not an easy thing for them to do. One of them, a guy at Ohio State named Jason Box, who's a really important glaciologist there, just said, what was I going to do? You know, I've spent the last 12 summers on Greenland watching it melt. If anyone should be here, it should be me, you know, and that seems sensible to me. The other thing that was important about those demonstrations was that we said, if you want to come, we need you in a necktie or a dress, okay? We want you in your Sunday best. I live in Vermont, you know, we don't really go for neckties that much. Not because I like neckties, because we wanted a visual way to say what is important here, which is that we're not in any sense of the word extreme or militant or radical. Not in any way. All anyone's asking for is a planet a little bit like the one that we were born on to, you know? Radicals work at oil companies and coal companies. If you're willing to get up in the morning and go to work altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere in ways that every scientist by now has told you is a crazy idea, then you are by definition a radical. Indeed, you're engaging in a more radical act than any human being has ever managed to engage in before. Now, all of us help in one way or another by burning that fossil fuel, but it's the fossil fuel industry that takes the money and buys the politicians and prevents the change from ever happening. That is radical, and we have to figure out how to bring that radicalism to a halt. Until we've been doing this, obviously, a long time, since the start of the Industrial Revolution. But it was Dr. Keeling and his colleagues who made it into, at some level, a moral and political issue. They were the first ones to force us to come to terms with what we were doing. And even then, in the 1960s, it wasn't yet clear how dangerous it was. It wasn't really until the 1980s that we had a clear sense that we were going right to the boundary of where danger lay. But now it's the most important moral issue that human beings have ever faced. There is no guarantee that we will win. I can't say, you know, what Martin Luther King always used to say at the end of every talk, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice, you know. It's going to take a while, but we're going to win. I can't tell you that. I mean, the arc of the physical universe appears to be fairly short and bending toward heat, you know, at this point. I can't tell you we're going to win. I can just tell you because I've been in 1,000 rooms like this around the world, many of them in places where they're doing nothing to cause this problem, that there are people everywhere willing to engage this fight. And it's always an honor to be in those rooms, and it is the most special honor, really one of the great honors of my whole life, to get to be in this room and to get to say thank you so much for the work that you've already done, scientific and political and in every other way. And just to say I look forward very much to standing shoulder to shoulder with you as we go forward and figure out what we can still do about all of this. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.